Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation, Dae-Chen Sarin of the Global Fund for Women explains why and how millions of girls and women are victimized by human trafficking every year. Sarin tells girls' stories to demonstrate what factors contribute to this grave human rights violation and how the Global Fund for Women is working in Asia to help stop it.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation.
Good afternoon, I suppose. Yeah, good afternoon to everybody. So my name is Dae-Chen Sarin, and I am the Program Officer for Asia and Oceania region at the Global Fund for Women. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the Global Fund for Women in a few seconds. I've been at the Global Fund for about a year and a half. Before that, I've always worked in nonprofit, so it's about 10, 15 years already of work in nonprofit. So the Global Fund for Women was started in 1987, so we're approaching our 20th anniversary next year. We're quite excited about that. It was started here, actually, in Palo Alto by Anne Firth Murray and two friends of hers. But the genesis of the whole idea really came from Anne Firth Murray, who essentially felt that there wasn't enough money or no money at all out there for specifically for women's rights issues. And she sort of thought that this is now it's high time by mid, late 80s that foundations should be giving and individuals should be giving grants towards that are specifically geared for women's rights issues. And her vision was to think of people living free of poverty as violence and injustice, which are some of the root causes of a lot of the violence that women face in the world and the violation of basic human rights of women. And we regard women's rights as human rights, you know, in this. Our mission, the Global Fund's mission, has been right from the start and continues to be to advance the human rights of women. We provide funds around the world to women's groups, women-led groups, that to help them seed, strengthen, and link women's rights groups around the world. Our core activities, which is what we do, means raising the resources here in the Global West to bring to the Global South. And these resources, as you'll see later when I talk about some of our grantees in Cambodia and Thailand, really bring individuals and groups together to talk about women's issues, how they're going to address these issues, and how we as collective women groups will do the advocacy that's necessary to bring attention, not just at the national level, but at the regional and global level as well. Anne Firth Murray was the founding president for 10 years, founding president of Global Fund for the first 10 years. And this is Kavita Ramdas in the center, now our current president and CEO of Global Fund for Women. We just celebrated her 10th anniversary with the Global Fund, and we hope she'll have many more years with us. And this is during her visit to Cambodia last October, during which we took several donors of the Global Fund and staff to do a donor education. And I'll tell you a little more about that also. The Global Fund gives grants in six different themes. And again, these global themes were really put together as a way of simplifying, in some sense, the kinds of issues that we fund. But as you can imagine, many of the groups that we give grants to are multifaceted. They approach the issues of women's rights from all these different themes simultaneously. But just to sort of bring it to the outside world a little more simplified, these are the six areas in which we work, and many of our grants are classified according to these six grants. Although, again, many of the groups may fit in any of these grants themes. And I'm not going to read it all out to you. I think it's self-explanatory. We also work with grantees as partners. We see ourselves, of course, there's a role of a funder and a fundee, the Global Fund's whole value of grant making is based on respecting the knowledge, the skills, and the capacity of the women themselves to recognize what it is that they want to do for their own issues and within their own cultural and regional context, community context. So we have conveniently taken the UN division of the globe into five regions, and each region has a program officer and a program associate, with the exception of Africa, who recently got a second program associate because they get about 1,800 proposals a year. And then it's followed by Asia and Oceania, which we get about 800 proposals a year that we go through. And we have an open door policy in terms of proposals coming in. So we don't necessarily go out and solicit proposals. They come in any time of the year and we address them. And as I was explaining to Elizabeth on our write-up, we have four grant-making cycles a year. So it comes pretty soon, one after the other, because the proposals keep coming in. Since 87, we have grown and we continue to grow. We have awarded over 5,000 grants, totaling about $50 million, and in about 163 countries now. Last year alone, we made $7.7 million in grants to more than 600 women's groups. Now, each year, we get about 3,000 proposals, so we're not able to really address, you know, all of these. As you can imagine, the resources are limited, and so we do have our limitations on that regard. But we work very closely with a diverse group of staff. I myself am from originally Tibetan, from India, grew up in India. Actually, if anyone knows the history, we fled our country in 1959 and then settled in it as refugee communities. So likewise, some of the other regional program officers are all from their own regions. And we also work with regional advisors, a global set of advisors, over 160 advisors, who are women activists in their own right. They run their own organizations. They are activists as well as researchers within the field of women's human rights. And so we really look to them as our ears and eyes on the ground, if you may, because the Global Fund we have one office that's in San Francisco. And we don't have any other regional offices, purely because we want to put as much of our grant money into the women's groups as possible. And about 78% of our grants, the funds that we receive, go directly to the women's groups. So let me read you a story. I thought I'd just start with a story that I borrowed from the Asia Foundation website. But the reason I'm choosing this story is because I think it will give you a picture of the multifaceted, complicated sort of causes and that create for, you know, women being trafficked. And then later we'll go into what are we talking about when we say traffic. So bear with me. This is a story that the names, of course, have been changed. And it's a pretty typical kind of story. Every day after school, Bopa sold bread by the side of the road to supplement her family's limited income. When business was slow, the 15-year-old chatted with Soka, a 35-year-old woman who lived in the same village in Bante Manche province, which is along the northwest of Cambodia towards the Thailand border, and often stopped by to visit. The two developed a friendship, and in December 2004, Soka made Bopa an offer. She promised a high-paying job in Phnom Penh that would allow Bopa to send home money, helping her family out of poverty. Bopa agreed and, at Soka's urging, did not tell her parents she was leaving. On the day of the trip, Soka gave Bopa a drink that made her dizzy, then unconscious. When she awoke, the two of them were in a taxi driving to an unfamiliar Phnom Penh restaurant. Soka told Bopa to go in and clean up, after which the taxi driver drove her and three other girls to a guest house. One after another, he called them inside. Bopa was the last. Inside the guest house, the taxi driver raped her. Stunned and broken, but feeling powerless to stop the events, Bopa was brought back to the restaurant, where she was forced to waitress for a month until Soka returned. When she did, she claimed to be Bopa's mother and collected the girl's wages, then relocated her to a restaurant in Battambang, which is also to the northwest of Cambodia. There, Bopa again was forced to wait tables, but soon the servitude extended to sex with customers in a back room. Weeks later, the cycle repeated. Soka arrived, Bopa's earnings were claimed, and transported her to, this time back to a Bante Manche, this time to a karaoke parlor. Suspicious of Soka and Bopa's relationship, the owner alerted local authorities, who took no action. Bopa was sexually molested again, repeatedly. Sofa's salvation finally came when one night her uncle happened to visit the parlor. Recognizing his niece, he informed her parents, who sought assistance from the Cambodian Human Rights and Development Association in Bante Manche. And then the story goes on to talk about how this organization came to support, came to the Soka's help and got her out of that situation. And in Cambodia, the perpetrators, if they are taken to court, can get up to 20 years imprisonment. And in this case, the perpetrator got 10 years, which was the woman who coerced and tricked the 15-year-old. But the taxi driver was set free. There was no accusation against him. The courts felt that there were no charges, not enough proof that he had actually raped her and the other girls at the time. And so he wasn't convicted, and the judges refused to summon any testimonies. So this story hopefully gives you a little picture of what young girls, how they can be tricked, and what are the social factors that lead them to these desperate situations unknowingly. Trafficking. What do we mean by trafficking? According to a UN definition, the Protocol to Prevention, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking Persons, trafficking is the act, and it's the act of recruitment, transportation, transfer, harbor, or receipt of persons by the means of these different ways. Threat, again, of or the use of force in this form, coercion, abduction, fraud, and deception, as you heard in the story, the abuse of power, or of a position of vulnerability, which is where Bopa was when she heard about this lucrative job opportunity, the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another, and all of this for the purpose of exploitation. And this is a picture just to show you a migrant worker in the Thai-Burma border This was one of our initial grantees in the Thai-Burma border. Again, exploitation of the prostitution of others, or the other forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor, slavery or practices similar to slavery, servitude, as you heard in the story, and also the removal of organs in certain cases, particularly in China. Apparently this is now on the increase, where people are being coerced into selling their organs, drugged first, and then found that their organs are missing. The point of this definition is that trafficking does not just mean sex trafficking. And that's something that we at the Global Fund really want to look at when we make our grants to women's groups. Are they addressing trafficking purely from just as sex workers, or looking at the economic factors, such as these migrant women from mostly from Vietnam? There are about over 10,000 Vietnamese women trafficked each year across the border into Cambodia. And sometimes they are transit there, sometimes they are transit on their way to Thailand or China, and sometimes they are there working, coerced into working into garment factories, where actually for these young ladies, you know, $2 a day is a lot of money. $1.50. I was in Vietnam in October, and there were Vietnamese women near the border who were very eager to go across the border to work for a factory that would pay them 50 cents more than what they're making. And their earnings were about $1 a day. So, you know, if you imagine Vietnam, Cambodia, you know, the poverty level in that country is extremely high, among the highest in the Asia region. And this was a factory workers that the group visited when we went to Cambodia, when the Global Fund team went to Cambodia. What is our position on trafficking? Again, not all sex workers are trafficked or forced. This is another important distinction that we try and make, because we are not talking about, as the US government states in their gag rule, the global gag rule, as some of you may have heard, is that if you eliminate prostitution, it'll eliminate trafficking. And essentially, I mean, very simply put. And that's not what we believe. We do believe that there women, one must take a human rights-based approach, that women may choose to be sex workers, and that we have to respect the freedom for that choice. But getting rid of prostitution or illegalizing prostitution is not the answer. And the human rights-based approach that we take is the right to freedom from servitude, right to bodily integrity, right to freedom from persecution, arbitrary arrests, which happens a lot. There's a lot of raids that happen where the sex workers are then imprisoned and persecuted for being in the brothel. And this, as you can imagine, can create another cycle where they are even more devalued in society than they already are. And the trauma of being persecuted and imprisoned in a foreign country where they may not speak the language at all and don't know anybody. And also it's used as a very effective threat by the brothel owners and by the traffickers. If you say something, you know, if you try and escape this, you can be arrested, and then what are you going to do? You know, and so these policies, in effect, create for a lot of underground work that happens in trafficking, and also the fear that it generates. Right to medical and psychological treatment. Many of these women, when they are arrested, they don't receive any kind of counseling, at least by the state, and often are, again, as I mentioned, traumatized by the whole experience, and many of them have reproductive health issues that need caring, and they don't get that. Respect and protection is a priority in the way that we look at trafficking and the trafficked women and sex workers overall, and that we really don't believe in branding them as immoral because we don't know all the conditions. We really have to take a more holistic approach of where they're coming from. And here again are women in the factories. This is a garment factory in Cambodia that our group visited. They look rather happy, as you might think, but when we look at the conditions in which they are living and the conditions in which their families live, the money, the little money that they earn and the hardship that they go through often seems like not much, but they have no other place to go if they get raped by the team leader. The garment factory contractors, they often get molested. Sexual abuse and harassment is a common phenomenon in these factories. Why is trafficking such a big issue? It's a giant industry. It's 2.45 million trafficked persons worldwide. This is according to the UN State of the World Population Report that came out this year. The number of women and girls trafficked each year is actually impossible to determine. As you can imagine, there are many that are underground, there are many that go unreported, and many women don't even realize that they have been trafficked until much too late. NGOs also estimate that there are over 100,000 trafficked people coming into the United States per year, and 1.4 million that are trafficked around international borders. This is by NGO, non-government organizations, estimates. So over 600,000 to 800,000 people get trafficked around the international borders. 80% of them are women and girls. So there are some boys. Often it's young men or boys who get trafficked. And it's the third most lucrative trade after arms and narcotics. And some reports have shown that in the next 5 years, the trafficking industry could take over the industry of narcotics, drugs trade. There's a lot of money in trafficking. It's in the initial sales, that means the first stage of traffic, as you may call it, transaction, $7 to $12 billion per year is raised by this particular industry. And as a follow-up, the perpetrators of trafficking earn as much as $32 billion a year. This is, of course, global, per year in income. One-third of this alone is in Asia. So Asia is actually one of the most active. Of course, Eastern European countries are also very active in the trade of trafficking. And many women from Eastern Europe actually end up here in the United States as well. But Asia is one of the most active. So what is Global Fund doing? We are approaching this holistically. We are looking at, of course, we are a grant-making organization, so we make grants to grassroots women's groups. Through these grants, we are challenging the inequalities facing women. We also organize international convenings on trafficking. We did that just recently, again in March of 2006, where various activists, human rights activists around the trafficking issue came together in New York to speak about the issue of trafficking and prostitution. We had different organizations that actually some of them had never sat down with the groups that talked about, you know, let's get rid of prostitution overall. And so it was a very a lively discussion and some strategies and some action, call for action, has come about, fortunately. And these two groups have been seeing eye to eye on certain issues, such as the need for a holistic approach. We also do donor activism and education around these issues. As I mentioned earlier, we had donor trips. In 93, we had a donor circle against trafficking and forced prostitution, which was really a group of Global Fund donors who were very interested in the subject of trafficking and got together, visited grantees, and came out with a video that's called Sisters and Daughters Betrayed. Now, it's about 10 years old, this video, but sadly, the content of it is still relevant today, if not more so than ever before. And the video is there. It's available for sale through the Global Fund. I believe we're putting it back on the website, and I believe it's about $25 individual and $35 for institutions. So it'll give you sort of a perspective on trafficking as well.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Rob Lepper. Our website editor was Kat McConnell. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Steigelmeier
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.